The Autoblog podcast is brought to you by TireRack.com, the leading online source for tires and so much more, including a large selection of winter tires, as well as aftermarket wheels, suspension, and brake components, and those items that make it easier to see, like windshield wipers and replacement lighting. No matter what your vehicle, check them out at TireRack.com. This is Autoblog podcast number 364. This week, Autoblog executive editor Chris Pockert and I talk about the Detroit Auto Show. I also had the chance to talk with Matt O'Leary, vehicle line director for the new Ford F-150. And we wrap up with the 2014 North American Car and Truck of the Year Awards. That's all on Autoblog podcast number 364. Starts now. Welcome to the Autoblog podcast. I'm Dan Roth, and I'm joined this week by Autoblog editor, executive editor. I was going to say editor-in-chief, but that's not right. So
that would not be right. No, but thank you for trying.
Hey, I give you a promotion. Chris Pockert.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great. You are finishing up the second day of Detroit Auto Show coverage. We'll probably focus pretty much the exclusive podcast, the entire podcast on Detroit coverage, because that's the big news this week. Everything else got kind of lost in the shuffle, as it should, because it's a big show. It's sort of the first. It's a great way to kick off the year. So I guess we could cover the garage if you've been driving yourself to and from the show.
I have, and it's a little bit of a haul for me since I'm out in the sticks now.
Okay, so what have you been driving yourself to and from the show with?
This week I've had the 2014 Buick Regal Turbo all-wheel drive.
That's not a crappy way to get around.
No, I mean, it's really not. It's especially nice to have all-wheel drive since we've had some tremendous snow, and then it melted and turned to ice and such. So having the security of all-wheel drive has been really nice. And they've done a lot of meaningful updates for 2014. You know, for one, everything has the turbo now, which is, you know, similar to the GS motor. And so you've got plenty of power. You've got, I think, 260 horsepower almost. And a little under 300 foot-pounds of torque. So it's plenty of power to move around. And I like some of the updates they've made. I think the styling looks pretty sharp. And it's certainly a comfortable vehicle. You know, nice to have heated leather seats and a wheel in weather like this. But overall, I'm sort of lukewarm on the car, I got to be honest with you, especially in view of the price.
What is the price?
Well, this is a fairly highly optioned model. This is the Premium 2 group. There is a Premium 3, but this one has an advanced safety package, driver confidence package number 1, which has forward collision alert, rear cross traffic alert, lane departure warning, memory seats, blind spot assist, that sort of stuff. And then another one with adaptive cruise, automatic collision prep, and then a standalone option of a power sunroof. So what would you place this car at?
When you go like Premium 2 and there's Premium 3, it's like, okay, so it's like in Spaceballs, like ludicrous speed, and then they've gone plaid. I'm guessing that's a $42,000 car.
Oh, well, you know what? You're actually a little bit pessimistic there. It's $40,445 delivered.
Okay, that's a lot of money for a Regal.
That was kind of my reaction. I really think, you know, I know Buick has upmarket aspirations as a brand. And I'm not saying that this is a bad car, because I don't think it's a bad car, but I think it's an awful lot of money for a car that I really consider to be more of a competitor to a Honda Accord.
TSX even.
And it's something like that. The TSX is old at this point, and so this has a nicer interior and some higher tech features. But I really think the idea of this as a luxury car is a little threadbare. We had a big debate about this actually with some of the editors this week, because they knew I was driving it. And I really think of it more as a family sedan.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that's really
tight one at that. I mean, it's a little bit smaller than a lot of the competition.
Yeah, and that's really what it is. I mean, honestly, it's a smaller Malibu with it's got a smaller back seat too. So it kind of, at that price point, you're like, you're in 3 Series territory with something that's 3 Series size, and I mean, yes, you get a lot more equipment, but the dynamically it's very nice, but it's also it doesn't play in that echelon of performance.
Scenarios. No, and I mean I'm not confident that I would take this over a Fusion all-wheel drive, for instance. I mean, there's not a lot of family sedans that you can get with, you know, grips at all forward traction. The Fusion is one of those, and you could get a really nice titanium with nav for 35. I feel like this is, you know, it's at least 5K overpriced. I have a hard time with that. And I think the market reflects that. The demand on this car, even with the updates, I think is still quite low. I was hoping that they would bring the price down when they started manufacturing it in Canada.
Yeah.
Because originally, you know, they were bringing them over from Europe and they were, you know, that's a hideously expensive process. But now, you know, I think they think that they can charge it and then that will sort of make their aspirations for a premium brand true. And I don't see it.
That has not proven to be so. I mean, it is it's a nice car, but it's one of those nice cars at 33, 34, not 44 or 40 even. And, you know, maybe because you're feeling like it should be 5,000 less. Well, that's probably the kind of money they've got on the hood of that car to get it to sell.
It probably is. And I think I'm being a little bit generous at 5K. I really don't feel like I would take this car over something like an Accord. You know, a very nice, I don't think it handles as well. I don't know that the interior is necessarily more premium, or that the driveline is more refined. I mean, granted, again, all wheel drive. So you're limiting yourself in class. I don't know. I think they're missing out with this car.
Well, and what are their sort of their plans too? Like, it's been around a while. They've sort of tried a few different things. They had the Regal, then they've done it with a turbo, and part of it is maybe they're not telling their story enough. But I'm not really sure where it fits among even its segment. You know, it's kind of an odd man out car. But hey, when you're looking for a turbo in the winter, it's not too bad, I suppose.
No, and. You know, honestly, I think sometimes as journalists, we struggle with the rationale with these front-wheel drive-based near luxury cars. Things like a Lexus ES is, you know, a luxury car because the Lexus brand is well-respected. But something like a Nissan Maxima or a Kia Cadenza, we look at those a little bit sideways, wondering why people would spend the extra money for what is, in reality, you know, a tarted-up mainstream family sedan.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think people do it anyway. I mean, the Maxima is a huge profit center for Nissan. It's you know, probably one of their most profitable vehicles, period. And they do pretty good volume with it, and that's an old car. And I suspect, you know, Buick figures that it can get some more volume out of this car and make some money. But they're not there yet.
Well, I mean, I guess in that sense, too, it's Epsilon hardware. It's not really like they had to reinvent a car to make that vehicle. So they've spent a little bit to create the Buick version of it. But overall, it fits in with everything else they're building. It's not that big of a stretch to make that car. So
no, but I think they do a better job with some of the other vehicles. I mean, I think the Encore is unique, obviously, in its segment size and what it offers. I think historically, the Enclave has done really well for that brand. I mean, it's been a big conquest vehicle for getting people in from other cars.
Yep.
And other brands. And even though they just did a refresh on that, I think that's, you know, a little behind the curve as well. But those vehicles sell. The Encore has sold. The Enclave, sells. The LaCrosse sold quite well for a while. The Regal, not so much.
Yeah, well, the Regal's in that place. I really think Buick's sort of strengths right now are... Maybe I should say that the Regal strikes me as really the only truly kind of weak vehicle within Buick. I mean, you've got the Encore, which was kind of a surprise hit, although it seems like it was a surprise to everybody but Buick because it's been popular with the very people they said it was going to be popular with. So kudos.
That's true. But even their prediction, and, you know, automakers, when they release predictions, they're typically under by, you know, 20%. Cover their butt a little bit in case things don't go well. It's been well above that, and I think it's been a really solid story for them. It's a unique vehicle in the segment.
Yeah. And then they've got Verano and Enclave and LaCrosse. Like, all four of those, they do okay, and they're well-respected within their niche. The Regal's kind of like a shrug.
Yeah, they're getting better. I mean, they had, if we look globally, they just announced, I think this week even, that they had their best sales year globally ever with over 1 million units. But of course, the vast majority of that is overseas thanks to China.
Yeah, well, and that's going to continue to be the Buick story for as long as we're going to be able to tell it for a while. I mean, Buick is strong because it's strong in China, and it, you know,
Buick exists because of Buick in China.
So, I mean, speaking of expensive, I guess it's luxury, but not near luxury. I'm driving a $70,000 Lexus GS, which made my eyes pop out of my head. It's the GS450H. And I like the regular GS, the GS350. I feel like the addition of the hybrid stuff makes this car a lot less enjoyable. Have you driven the hybrid GS?
I have not driven the hybrid version, although I like the GS quite a bit. I think it's a really well-rounded vehicle. And although when you say 70K, I kind of blanch a little bit.
Right.
I mean, the reality is I've seen, you know, 5 Series with, you know, small screens in them and no navigation and very low option counts, you know, well into the 60s. So,
right. I mean, in that sense, it's, if you're comparing it against the 5 Series, it's certainly a better bargain, especially because, you know, you get the reason why it's up there at 70,000 is it has the hybrid system. And, you know, in terms of hybrids, Toyota and Lexus do them very, very well, almost probably better than anybody else. So it's a pretty refined hybrid, but it's just the basic cars is good. So when you start adding the propulsion system, switching from gas to electric, and the braking, when it does its regeneration to actual friction braking handoff and stuff, it just introduces this level of weirdness on a fundamentally very good car, and it doesn't help it. You know, it's just kind of like, oh, this is kind of a drag.
What kind of fuel economy have you been getting?
I was getting 29 with it for the week. So, I mean,
depending on what you were doing, that's a pretty handsome figure for something that big.
That's a big car to get that kind of fuel economy with. I mean, it's still got a usable trunk. It's got, you know, the Lexus sedans. Now they have very nice interiors. You do pay a penalty for the low rolling resistance tires. It's a sharp looking car. You know, I like the IS and the GS. They look nice. It's well optioned. It's, you know, overall, it's a very well rounded car. It's just $70,000. It's a lot of money for, I mean, it gets up there. It was surprising to me how much it was. I would have been a little bit more, you know, again, like thinking like, okay, 65 or so would have made it feel more palatable. And I realize it's only like $5,000 difference, but seeing the 7 on the sticker really shocked me.
What's $5,000 among friends?
I know. but I'm going to say, like, if you're in the market for the GS, drive because the thing is, like, it's supposed to add performance too, right? Like, it replaces a V8 at that level. You get fuel economy and you get the extra performance, and you do get more performance in terms of acceleration and torque and things like that, but it just, the driving experience doesn't get, it's not helped by the retrofit to a hybrid. Although I know that there's a lot of desire for a hybrid in the GS. Like, that's a popular car among folks that shop the GS. So it makes sense to have it.
Yeah, it exists for a reason.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, people love them some Lexus hybrid. You know, I will say that my money would be on an IS anyway, so who am I to talk? They don't make a hybrid version of that for the U.S., so. But we should talk about the Detroit Auto Show, because that thing happened this week. It was just a quiet little time for you guys, I'm sure.
Yeah, it started yesterday and ran through today, and some major debuts. The F-150, Ford did a really nice job kind of keeping that vehicle under wraps, even though we've been hearing for not just weeks or months, but, you know, quite a long time that it was going to be an aluminum intensive vehicle. It was still pretty impressive to hear that they are, you know, at 700 pound loss or more in some cases, from what I understand. And this is my first time seeing the Mustang. I know they showed it at SEMA, but this is the first auto show for it. And, you know, of course, they had the multi-city debut, which some people attended, but it hasn't been on the auto show circuit yet. So that was a big deal. The Chrysler 200 and the WRX STI for enthusiasts. So there was quite a bit.
Yeah, there was a bunch of stuff. And, you know, it probably makes a good point for us to break. I actually had a chance to talk with Matt O'Leary from Ford, who's the vehicle line director for the F-150. It got their take. You know, the Ford guys are very impressively polished when it comes to staying on message. But, you know, he took some time out on Monday to talk with me about the F-150. So we can go to that interview. And then I'd love to follow up and see what your thoughts on that truck were from seeing it live on the show floor. Well, Matt O'Leary from Ford Motor Company, I want to say thank you for joining us on the Autoblog podcast. And, yeah, let's talk F-150. What's the we've heard rumors about it, of course, and now that we can finally talk about it, it seems like the big story is that it's a lot lighter and that it's a lot stronger.
That's right. I mean, you know, our customers told us they wanted a vehicle that was tougher, smarter, and more capable. And we've done that with the new F-150. It really starts in terms of weight, lightweight. It really starts at the backbone of the truck, the frame. It's all new. It's high-strength steel. Quite an increase from the outgoing model. We were about 23% high-strength steel. Now we're 77% high-strength steel. So significantly lighter and stiffer than the prior F-150. And then we've gone to aluminum, high-strength aluminum alloy in the body itself. Over 95% of the body structure is this high-strength aluminum alloy. And together with other weight reductions we've done throughout the vehicle, we've saved up to 700 pounds in the vehicle. And that does so much for the customer in terms of, you know, being able to accelerate quicker, stop shorter, really get much better fuel economy. So we're really, really excited.
Well, can we talk about the aluminum a little bit? You know, one of the things that we've always heard is that it's a little difficult to work with, and we've seen it on a lot of high-end sports cars and smaller production vehicles, but you guys sell almost 800,000 trucks a year. What were some of the challenges to bring that to the market?
Well, one, we do have a lot of experience as a company on aluminum vehicles. You know, we used to own Jaguar and Aston Martin, and those were aluminum-intensive vehicles as well. But since that time, you know, the aluminum technology has come a long way. There's a lot of different alloys available and also a lot of different heat treatments for the material to give it the properties that we need. One, to be strong, but also to make it something that we can manufacture easily, you know, on a very high-volume product like the F-150.
And so with the F-150, you're looking around. Did you have to keep an eye on the competition now? I mean, it feels like, I'm sure it must feel like, even though you have the best-selling pickup out there, you've got Ram and the Chevy trucks and GMC breathing down your neck. What are some of the biggest considerations that are all new for the F-150 that you know, weren't there maybe the last time you launched a truck, which was a while ago now?
Well, you know, we've had the best-selling pickup truck in America for 37 years running, and actually for 32 years the best-selling vehicle of any kind in the U.S., the F-Series vehicle. And, you know, to be a leader, you have to lead. And we lead because we know our customers better than anyone else. And we let the customer guide us. We don't worry too much about the competition. Yeah, we look to see what they're doing. But really, our success is based on knowing the customer and letting the customer guide us. And it really, as I said before, is all about having a tougher, smarter, more capable vehicle than our current vehicle. And when we started the pre-program work on the new F-150, we said, you know, how are we going to go after this in a way that really sets us apart in our customer's mind. It really gets to the levels, the expectation that our customers are looking for in the future.
And what were some of those things? What were the, how have you made the F-150 tougher? And I mean, we've talked about that a little bit with the stronger frame, but tougher and smarter. And what were the customers asking for that you weren't giving them that you are now?
Well, if you look at some of our customers today, they're using technology in many different ways to get work done, even using drones to get some of the work done. So they want and expect a high level of technology that helps them get their work done. So we have in this truck, to make it smarter, 11 new class-exclusive features that help people get work done. For example, we've got the 360-degree camera view, which makes it easy to get in and out of tough spots or, you know, trying to, if you will, look around the corner as you're coming out into traffic to make sure you're safe. We've got the industry-first 400-watt outlet in the cab, so you can even charge, you know, your power tools with that type of an outlet. Most today have no more than 150 watts, so it's a significant improvement. Mm-hmm. We also have a remote tailgate release, which you can hit remotely, and it'll drop the tailgate down to the damp, so it doesn't just bang down. But that helps you loading things in and out of the vehicle. And even things like our box accessories that allow you, they have cleats in there. And you can use it for tie-down. You can also use it to store ramps, which we offer optional. So you can drive up, you know, motorcycles or ATVs into your pickup box, and you can store these on the side so they're out of the way and don't take up any usable space in the pickup box. So we've really thought through a number of different ways our customers use the vehicle and how to make it more productive.
You guys took one of these down to Baja, and there was a little bit of subterfuge because you couldn't let anybody know that it was the new F-150. How did that go? What was that like?
We did enter the thinly disguised F-150 in the Baja 1000. Now, this vehicle had the new frame for the vehicle. It had an aluminum body, and most importantly, it had our all-new 2.7-liter EcoBoost V6. We ran that through the entire Baja event without any breakdown. The only thing we had to do was change the oil filter, the air filters, during the competition, and it made it fine. In fact, afterward, we took that same truck and drove it back from Phoenix to Dearborn. And that vehicle will be at the North American International Auto Show for our customers to see. So we've really put this vehicle through 10 million miles of built-for-tough orchard testing to, you know, guarantee to our customers this is one tough truck.
We talked with Gordon, who designed the Atlas concept. We talked with him when we saw that last year. And the design is definitely... You know, it certainly looks like a Ford truck. It certainly evolved. Let's get a little touchy-feely for a moment. You know, what's your thought when you look at this truck? You know, I mean, you've spent years now working on it. What's the thing that you the emotion that swells up when you look across the room at Detroit at this vehicle?
Well, you know, to me, it's got a very good stance. You know, we widen the vehicle, widen the track in the width of the vehicle as well, about 40 millimeters. And we've made it look even tougher than the outgoing product. And it seems for our customers, you can never make it too tough, yet have it look refined enough. If, you know, F-150 customers like to take their truck out and work during the day and then clean it up and drive it to go out to work later in the evening. So it has to have that balance. And it's got some really unique signature lighting, both in the headlamp and the tail lamp that you can see during the day. This is on our higher end series that's really going to pop as people drive around. You're going to know it's an all new F-150. And I just think, you know, the level of refinement and toughness in this truck is so much more than anything we've ever done before. I think our customers are going to be just as excited about it as we are.
And so that's the F-150. What does this new truck mean for the Super Duties and the heavier duty trucks as it goes? Are we going to see those vehicles? And I know this is sort of speculating on future products, so I'm sure that there's only so much you can say, but are we going to see aluminum proliferate through the cabs of all the trucks that Ford builds, even the heavier duty ones?
Well, I think, as you know, Dan, we don't comment on future products. But obviously, you know, this is lightweighting is very important to our customers in terms of, you know, fuel efficiency and also adding more capability, right? Because you can haul more and tow more. And as I said before, it also allows you to accelerate quicker and stop shorter. So this is what our customers are demanding, and we're going to meet those things.
You know, one of the things that I always like to hear about is sort of the story of how a vehicle became what it is. Were there any particular challenges or things that you just had to really sit down and scratch your head to work out, how are we going to get this on the truck because we really want it and it's going to be a challenge?
Well, I think, really, I mean, there's so many different examples, Dan, of trying to get things in that make it difficult. I mean, I'll just pick a small one to give you a sense. We have the blind spot monitoring on this truck, and up to this point, we haven't been able to offer it on the truck because you can't have a radar unit that tries and look, you know, that goes through metal, be that steel or aluminum. And so, but we knew this was something our customers would really want. So we worked a significant amount of time packaging the radar unit into the tail lamp of the truck. It took a lot of give and take, you know, to make sure we still had tail lamp that looked dynamite, because that's the jewelry on the vehicle, and to make sure it was functional and still able to hold this radar unit in the tail lamp so we could provide this technology to our customers. This is one of many examples where we sweat the details to get something into the truck that up to this point had not been able to.
Well, and I'm sure that we're all eager to actually see the results of those details being sweat. So you've got the new 2.7 liter EcoBoost. There's a 3.5 and the 3.5 V6, 3.5 EcoBoost, and then the V8s. Are you feeling pressure from smaller trucks that we've just seen the GMC Canyon, Chevrolet Colorado, sort of nibbling down at the end where you might expect the naturally aspirated V6 and 2.7 liter EcoBoost F-150 to play? Do you think that that's a significant area of the market that the F-150 is going to be challenged to fill, or is it more of a challenge for those compact trucks to beat the F-150?
Well, we made the decision years ago that we were going to expand F-150. And if you look at our customers, they're really looking for the added payload capability, the added room in the F-150 offers. And that's why this segment has been growing, you know, so much in the past few years. And not only are we increasing our sales, we're increasing our market share in this, you know, growing market. So we're pretty confident we've got the right strategy going forward with the F-150.
Well, good. Any sort of parting thoughts you want to leave us with? What's the first thing we should check out when we hop in the 2015 F-150? You know, where should our eyes go first?
Well, I think when you first get in the vehicle, I mean, you'll be amazed at how much more room it has and the great visibility that you have. I mean, it really gets your attention, and then all the technology. But to me, what you're really going to notice is when you drive the vehicle. It is so much different than anything else out there. It's really going to make people's heads turn.
Well, I'm looking forward to my chance behind the wheel, as I'm sure pretty much all of the all of the automotive journalists are. So I will say thank you, Matt O'Leary, for taking your time, vehicle line director for F-150 and other trucks at Ford. Thanks for taking the time to come on the Autoblog podcast and talk 2015 F-150 with us.
Well, thanks a lot, Dan. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
The Autoblog podcast is brought to you by TireRack.com, the leading online source for tires and so much more, including a large selection of winter tires, as well as aftermarket wheels, suspension, and brake components, and those items that make it easier to see, like windshield wipers and replacement lighting. No matter what your vehicle, check them out at TireRack.com. Okay, so aluminum was the big story with the F-150, and of course the styling that we saw a year ago, actually, from the Atlas concept, and we had Gordon Plato on back then to talk about it too. So I wasn't too surprised to see it come out wearing that Atlas styling. How does it look in person when you get up next to it?
It looks an awful lot like an F-150. It's not, you know, for being so revolutionary under the skin, it doesn't come across that way in person. I mean, it definitely has Atlas cues. And in fact, I kind of suspect that the production vehicle's design was finalized and then they built the Atlas.
That might be.
Which sort of exaggerated the cues. I mean, you see some of it in the grill. You definitely see it in the bracket-shaped headlamps. And all of that, but it still looks like, you know, a contemporary F-150, relatively conservative, but still has some of that Super Duty look to it that they've been doing the last few years. So I think it's a pretty handsome truck. I heard some, you know, negative reactions about the front end, but not a whole lot. And it's a really complete package. I mean, if you look, it's a pretty revolutionary product. The widespread adoption of aluminum and what that's going to mean for the industry as a whole is going to be really interesting to watch. Seems solid, and you hear all the little details about the way they've researched this vehicle. You know, everything from there's a new 2.7 liter EcoBoost as the one step up from the 3.5. They got rid of the 3.7 motor. Because the vehicle was light enough that they could lower the displacement on the base motor, which is a normally aspirated 3.5.
Right.
And then they added the 2.7, which is crazy to think about. You know, just a few years ago, if somebody said there was a 2.7 in a full size pickup in America, I mean, we'd all say you're nuts.
Yeah, and it's 2.7 EcoBoost though, so it's
correct.
It's not like it's a wimpy engine. I mean, just again though, going off that, if anybody said there's a twin turbo V6 in a, you know, full size pickup in America, again, people would say you're nuts.
Well, and the other interesting thing is, while Ford hasn't priced any of this stuff yet, and they haven't really released power ratings. I was talking to Mike Levine, who is one of the key guys over there on their PR team for trucks.
Yeah, I would love to have Mike back on. I'm working on getting him back on to talk about the F-150 and other things soon.
And it's interesting. They dropped the 6.2 and the 3.5 EcoBoost is now the top engine.
Well, that EcoBoost, I think it almost took them by surprise how popular it was. They knew it was going to be something that generated a lot of buzz and that people were going to sniff around, but it's so torquey and it does have an appetite for fuel, but again, like, it has a lot of power under your foot, and the only way to sort of get that kind of torque otherwise is a big V8 that's thirsty all the time. So you do realize fuel savings, and it's not a huge heavy engine. I mean, it's just a really modern truck. And so it's cool to see them take that idea, shrink the engine a little bit. And it's almost like the Mustang of trucks, right? They're sort of doing that, you know, powertrain dance with it, where for years it was, you can have the V6 or you can have three different V8s. What do you want? And now they're really being aggressive about pushing technology into the truck segment.
They are, and historically, I think everybody has felt that the full-size truck was sort of resistant to new technologies. But, you know, Ford has seen with the 3.5 that people will buy a V6 if it's a strong motor truck, which it is, and they've gotten like a 40%+ take rate on that motor. And then you see the Ram, and they've got innovations like the coil spring rear suspension and the 8-speed and, you know... air suspension and all of that. So we're really seeing a lot of innovation in a segment where, you know, you were just kind of happy to have a slightly less buckboard ride in a you know, successive generation and maybe, you know, some more toys inside.
Yeah, that's one of the things too, like that Matt was talking about, was the technology that's inside. You know, they've got the like work computer, or the screen that drives a lot of the things that are tuned directly for the truck buyer. They've added a bunch of stuff to just functionality stuff to the bed, and you know, integral step bumpers and stuff. Like they sound like little things, but when you're actually out using the truck, they're, you know, and you've seen them on the GM trucks and the Ram and stuff too, like you're saying. So trucks are very competitive, and that means they're all very good. I can't wait to get my hands on it, because one of the things about the old F-150, the outgoing one, was just, you know, everybody else redid their trucks. And so it felt like it got outpaced for a while. They've really been quiet about what they're doing, and they almost feel like they've leapfrogged, especially with the aluminum construction. And in our Q&A, one of our listeners actually wrote in and said, you know, do you think that the aluminum is something we're going to see in the Super Duties and the larger SUVs? And I don't know if you got Mike Levine to talk about any of that. I asked the question and I got the expected response was, we don't comment on future product, but I'm, you know, also he backed it up with, you know, of course we're looking at things like that. So I would expect, and maybe you can tell me if I'm crazy, but I would expect that we're going to see aluminum proliferate throughout their large trucks.
I think, I mean, they're so heavily invested at this point to get this vehicle out the door. I think they're going to, you know, there's going to have to be an education process out there, not just with the dealers and in particular with the service bays for repairs, but with the consumer. And they've taken some really smart steps. For instance, I understand that they doled out the beds just, you know, as prototypes, just the beds. And gave them to a lot of tradesmen and didn't tell them what it was made out of. They just said, go out there and beat the crap out of them, see what happens. So they got feedback on that. They already took the 2.7 EcoBoost. I think they took it off-road racing. They just didn't tell anybody because it was under the body of a conventional F-150.
Yeah.
So they've done a lot of really neat things. And there's, you know, it's not just one type of aluminum here. I think there's something on the order of 7 or 8 different metallurgies at work, you know. So the door skin aluminum might be different than what's in the bed.
Right. Well, it's kind of the same as when they build a car out of steel, right? You've got high strength steel in certain areas and mild steel, or, you know, just normal steel in other places where it doesn't need to be as strong or whatever. So,
right. I think the key thing, you know, is you know, once they get past the perception issue is there going to be an insurance ramification for this? And Ford claims that there will be comparable insurance rates. That's what they're expecting. And I'm sure I hope they did their homework and called around and got, you know, the various major insurance companies out to talk about this and kind of analyze it and prepare them for it. But it'll be interesting to watch.
Yeah. And it's, I expect that the biggest thing we're going to see from this actually is going to be mass manufacturing of aluminum bodies to a place where it becomes more affordable. Because there have been, of course, there's been aluminum cars. I mean, you know, Ford had Jaguar under their wing for quite a while, and so that was an aluminum intensive vehicle for sure. The XKs and the XJ8s at the end of the line there. So before Ford sold them, so they have experience with it. It's just that's a niche vehicle, and now you're going to the largest selling vehicle in the United States for 30 something years. You have to take into consideration how to make that manufacturing process affordable and repeatable and all of those things. So I think we're going to see aluminum become a lot bigger of a thing, almost like the Lexus study with carbon fiber and their supercar. He was going to bring that technology down to the mass manufacturer, sort of more affordable masses too. So there were other things at the show, though, right? There was more than just the F-150, as cool as it is.
Remarkably, there was.
Go ahead.
I was going to say there was a lot of cool stuff. You know, we saw the Chrysler 200 for the first time. That had been leaked all over the place, but that's a really promising vehicle. You know, we had the whole Autoblog editorial team crawling all over that thing, both the 200S and the 200C. And I think everybody came away pretty impressed with how it looks screwed together, the quality of the interior, the fit and finish, and the overall design. I'm a bit concerned that getting in and out of the back seat and the headroom back there is pretty tight. And of course it's one of those things that the proof will be in the pudding, with the driving. I think on paper, the Dart looked like a better vehicle than it turned out to be. So there was a lot of initial excitement.
It is like the Chrysler Dart. Well, it's
No. This is like their mid-sized sedan. So this is fusion sized, even though it has at its core some of the same Alpha DNA, you know, that the Dart has, and also the new Cherokee. It is fully size competitive with things like the Accord.
Wow, that's a lot bigger than it looks in pictures, and, you know, because I'm from afar, so I'm looking at it going, oh, it looks good. The interior looks good. The exterior looks like a Chrysler, and I mean that in the best way. It's a sharp car. Do you think that it's going to at least be more respected, or does that sort of depend on how many they dump into fleets?
Well, I mean, let's be honest. There's no place to go really but up with that. You know, the only things that were less respected than the Sebring before the 200 were things like the Mitsubishi Galant. I think they've done their homework. If you look at what's inside the car, we like the Pentastar a lot. The 9-speed, you know, the jury's still out on that a little bit. I liked it in the Cherokee. I didn't have any issues with it, but I know they've struggled to get that calibrated. But I think they'll do a good job with it. There's, you know, the V6 model comes with standard all-wheel drive, and it's an interesting system where it's got full rear axle disconnect, so that it can run around as a front-wheel drive car, and then on demand it can route up to 60% of the torque to the back axle.
Is that switchable like it was in like the SX4 and the Kizashi?
No, it's automated. I don't think there's any. I didn't see anything, and I've not read any indication that there's any sort of manual override for that. I think it's just that's what it is. I mean, if you flip it into sport mode, it'll divert 60% of the torque to the rear axle when called upon. So it could be a fun car to actually drive as well. And of course, you've got stuff like Uconnect, which we all really like. And I think the packaging, you know, the way the car looks, it's not going to offend anybody. The way that the wonky greenhouse on the last 200 looked. And certainly it's got the options, and it they've already released pricing, and it's well priced. In fact, I think it bases out less than the last model, which is really impressive. So it's all going to depend on how it drives. And I think if people are accepting of the rear seat packaging, it'll do well.
Yeah, well, the rear seat packaging in a lot of sedans isn't great anyway. I mean, it's even in the Fusion, it can be tight, you know, with that roof line. So, it's good to see. I feel like Chrysler's sort of getting their act together, but again, like, is there going to be a Dodge version of this? Do we know anything about any other prospects for this car, or is it just...
They have not confirmed an Avenger replacement officially, as far as I know, but I believe we all expect one.
Yeah. All right. Well, good. I mean, if it's a sort of a, I want to see where they go with it. Maybe they make it more performance oriented at that point, because there's that opportunity. You've got the Chrysler side, which can be more luxurious, and I don't know. I was impressed to see that they've kind of kept their mojo going over at Chrysler with this.
Well, they have, and I think it's really important that they get a hit that's a car, because really what's been driving their profits and I think their mind share has been trucks and SUVs. It's been Jeep. And Ram.
Yeah.
Because their cars really, I mean, the outgoing 200, I think, given what they started with, you know, with the Sebring, it was a pretty meaningful mid-cycle refresh and a name change. And it did bring them quite a few additional sales. So I think given what they had to work with, they did a good job with that, but it still wasn't a terribly good vehicle. The Dart has been a disappointment, both critically and in terms of sales. And I mentioned this in the, you know, the reveal post that I wrote. You know, the 300 hasn't really set the world on fire in terms of sales. That's a pretty nice vehicle, especially in Pentastar trim.
Yeah, I mean, I think the problem with the 300 is it's somewhat outside of the mainstream, right? Whereas the new 200, it's more of a mainstream. It's a more mainstream package. You know, it's a front-wheel drive based car with all-wheel drive available. It's a little bit smaller because the 300 feels big to a lot of people, and you lose some space efficiency. As much as we love the fact that it's based on a rear-wheel drive chassis, you lose some space efficiency for that. You know, you've got a center tunnel, and you know it could be more roomy if it were designed a different way.
Sure, I think that the issue is that it lost some of the visual impact that the first generation had, and it sort of had to, because the first generation really hit in a big way stylistically, right? I mean, it attracted a lot of people. It drew the comparisons to Bentley, and it was really brash. And that's sort of something you can't continue to do generation after generation. So it's a nice car. Sales are okay. But I think it's fair to say that Chrysler really hasn't had a hit car in a while, and it needs one. So hopefully this is it.
We'll see. Well, I'm sure we'll keep our eye on it. So where else did you find yourself sort of hanging out at the show? What else impressed you?
Well, you know, for a really long time now, for years, actually, we've been talking about, is Toyota going to do another Supra? And Toyota also did a really good job of keeping its mouth shut and pictures from leaking on this FT1 concept. And they really didn't give any information. So we don't know what powers this thing. We do know it was designed at their Calte studio in California. And it's not the cleanest looking thing. I mean, there's definitely a real presence to it. It's got a huge long nose with a sort of F1 influence to it. It's got active aero, and it's got some nice touches to it. But there's no details. There's no interior that we've seen, even though they've done some what looks like CGI mock-ups on video.
Right.
This will probably end up being, the Supra down the road with much different styling, or at least it portends the fact that they want to do a car like this. So I think that's exciting news. It's finally concrete proof that Toyota is serious about doing another sports car above the FRS.
That thing just, I mean, this FT1, it's funny, like Toyota's and Lexus is like the RCF that we also saw in Detroit. They just look like if you get too close, it'll cut you.
Yeah, well, and the Lexus looks like it's just going to eat you. Forget cutting you.
Yeah, that's I mean, the face on that, the giant bulge in the hood on that car, in the middle of the hood, is it that weird in person?
It comes together better. I think it's the first time that grill really looks at home on things, because it's pretty well over the top all the way around. I mean, it's definitely not going to be for everybody, but I think that's a good thing. So I think they'll find some friends with that design. I mean, that's basically the production car. So that's a happy thing. I'm trying to think of some of the other stuff. I mean, there was the Kia GT4 Stinger, which was much more compelling in person than I thought it would look in the photographs at first.
Yeah, I mean, that's something too. Like, we're a little puzzled by that because it's a rear-wheel drive sports car, and it's got a high-performance four-cylinder, slightly detuned from the Optima GTS race car. And it's, yes, they say, you know what, we're not going to produce this. We have no plans to produce this car at this time. And like in the next paragraph, Brandon pointed out in his post, he's like, in the next paragraph they say, but we do have quite a long history of bringing vehicles that are very similar to our concepts to market. So what are your thoughts about, is you got production for this?
Yeah.
Could we actually see it from Kia? What kind of a play would it be? Why would they bring it to market?
Well, I mean, I think they want to inject some excitement into the brand. For a long time, the strategy was let Hyundai be the luxury brand and Kia be the sportier performance brand. But, you know, it hasn't really worked out that way in terms of their product offerings. And I think they could do this. You know, they could get some scale if they can adjust the Genesis and kind of use some of that, the bits from Hyundai underneath. I think they could make a sales argument for it, but it would be an affordable halo car for them.
And it's physically smaller too, right? It's like FT86, GT86.
It is. Yeah, it's smaller in person than you think. You know, I'm not without criticism of some of the styling. You know, this, the lights are actually better in person, the headlights in particular. But if you look at that, I was talking with Brandon about this, and, you know, I noted there's no way those lights are going to be DOT compliant or, you know, make sense for insurance purposes when you have a 5 mile an hour ding, you're right into the lights everywhere.
Yeah, they're probably too low as well. But I mean, there's got to be a way to get the modern LED stuff packaged in that front end some way.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It's got a nice, you know, pretty business-like interior. It's got the, the A pillars that have the honeycomb look that right. You can see through, like the old Volvo SCC concept car.
Yeah, it's got really strong proportions too, especially like the towards the because it's like classic fastbacky kind of.
Yeah, looking. I think they're pretty serious about this. I mean, I made the point to the team that, you know, they bothered listing a weight for this thing. You don't normally do that for pure concepts, it was a pretty exact weight. I think they can build this car, and I'd really like to see it. I mean, it was one of the most entertaining things at the show to look at, and to contemplate the idea of, that's a pretty high amount of horsepower for such a small little car.
Yeah, well, and you know, maybe we're seeing a renaissance of coupes, I was going to say affordable coupes, but what we're really seeing a renaissance of is coupes on the high end, where, you know, we saw the ATS coupe as well debut, and that really brings it to that. I feel like every time there's an auto show, we say, well, Cadillac's finally, you know, gotten in the groove. But really, I mean, we haven't seen Cadillac bring a car this size that was sort of this mission to the market ever with the ATS coupe.
Yeah, I mean, it's first off, this car is smaller than you think. It's, you know, I think it's sub ELR sized, which is weird to think about. But I think, you know, I happened to see this car early at a background event, and I came away going, yeah, it's a handsome car. ATS is a handsome car in sedan format. It's a handsome car in coupe format. And I guess I was just, you know, with the way they've had their style chutzpah working, you know, for the last 5-10 years, I expected more. And this, you know, especially with after the CTS coupe and the sort of emotional language that carries, this is, to me, it almost felt like, I don't want to say that they were mailing it in, but it's really conservative. You know, they took the sashes off the door, they raked the backlight, they got rid of the back doors, and you have a coupe.
Yeah, and they did change the nose a little bit, so I feel like it's the best looking ATS as well. Not that any ATS is sort of bad looking, but it just, it comes together. It's nice. We've proven that the powertrain and the chassis is there to really play in the class. So it's not just like nice styling on top of sort of also ran hardware. They're there. And it's great to see that we're going to have another high end coupe, and we've got the BMW coupes as well. Audi, of course, created a stir at the show with their stuff. So maybe it's a dawning of a new era for coupes, two doors.
Yeah, we'll see. I mean, they still end up being pretty disappointing sales wise most of the time. You just hope on the luxury market you can make it in margin. I suspect this will eventually, and actually not really even eventually, I think pretty quickly replace the CTS coupe as the only gas only coupe in their lineup, because right now they've got three. They've got CTS coupe, they've got ATS coupe, and they have ELR, which is sort of its own little corner case.
Yeah, and I think maybe the ATS coupe will probably actually do better than the CTS coupe, because it is smaller and it is sort of a little bit more light, and it plays in a market that I feel like people actually look for, and they go after coupes versus, you know, the CTS it's starting to push into that larger car size. It's less manageable on the road. And then, you know, we also saw a couple of head scratchers, I think, at least from where I sit, the TLX prototype. First of all, I think they win hands down. I watched the video of their press conference. Acura wins hands down for like buzzword bingo and just like I don't want to curse, but just BS statements that don't mean anything, just like words mashed together. It was like watching a tech company launch from a decade ago. Like, well, we found synergies and we're just like, we're going to give you the, you know, most sports sedan ish kind of experience with the Acura TLX prototype car thing sedan. It's a weird press conference.
I actually did not go to that press conference. I know we have the video.
Yeah.
So on the strength of your description of it, I'm going to watch it a little later, maybe after we're done with the podcast.
Well, it's funny because they're like, I have hometown pride for their advertising agency because they're Mullen in Boston, and that's cool and all. But it's just a weird sort of way they're positioning Acura overall. It's just, you know, we wanted it to be a red carpet athlete. What the hell is a red carpet athlete?
You know, one of those athletes that presents well in a suit.
Don't they all, because they're athletes?
Well, I mean, you know, some of those linemen don't necessarily probably.
Yeah, that's true. The only time they wear a suit is to their arraignment. But
oh, that's nice.
Sorry. Let's get it back to the car now. TLX is going to do away with a couple of current Acuras and sort of slot in. I mean, there's noise from the Acura camp, but is it enough to sort of make them relevant is I guess my question, because I feel like as much as I like their cars, they don't really – nobody pays attention.
Yeah, and, you know, this is an interesting – this cleanup two-for-one strategy that they have. There's a lot of new powertrain work underneath, and I think it's really all going to come down to that. There's, you know, a 2.4-liter four-cylinder with an 8-speed dual-clutch transmission that's brand new. But what's weird about it that I picked up on in the press release, you know, we got that a little bit ahead of time, and I immediately went to Acura and I said, "What's this about?" And they wouldn't talk about it. And it has a torque converter, and it's a dual-clutch. Which is, I'm not exactly sure what the benefit of that would be and how that's integrated. My guess is it's for very slow speed refinement, you know, 0 to 5, 5 to 0.
Right.
But there's no explanation. I've asked for a follow up conversation with them, with some of their engineers to try and walk me through that so that I can help you guys understand what that is.
Well, it's going to have pause too. Pause.
Yeah. Yeah. It'll have all wheel steering, which is actually, I mean, it's a pretty trick system.
It is. That's the thing about Acuras too. It's like every time I drive one, I go, "This drives nice."
Yeah.
And so I expect that this car, because it's actually on a larger wheel. It's on the wheelbase of the larger car, but it's a you know, smaller sedan. But yeah, that torque converter thing, I actually wonder too if that's a way for them to integrate their you know, the integrated motor assist smoothly. As well, or maybe that's just speculation at this point. It might just be for refinement at low speeds, like you said.
Yeah, I mean, that would be a weird combination. iMotor with the dual clutch.
Yeah.
Even with a torque converter. I mean, that just sounds like there's a whole lot going on.
Yeah, a lot of extra stuff.
As opposed to an ECVT or something like that. I would be surprised to see that. The other combination is a DI V6, 3.5 liter. With a 9-speed automatic that's new. So there's a lot going on here. Super handling all-wheel drive is available, and that's a great system. So I'm kind of optimistic that this car is going to be really good to drive. Do I know that it'll move the needle for the brand? I'm not so sure. I mean, the styling to me, this is the prototype, and obviously it's probably 98% the production car.
Yeah, it's a production car with, like, different lights.
Yeah, well, no, I bet the lights are even the same. I think it's going to come down to things like the fascia and maybe the standard wheel size and the side mirrors. But I don't know. I mean, if you told me that Acura was going to come out with a model between the TL and the TSX, I could have, if I had any sense for proportion and scale, I could have drawn this car, you know, in my sleep, just because I know that this is the direction that they've gone with all of their other sedans. And in particular, we actually did a side-by-side shot on two laptops when we were sitting in the press room, the front end of this and the front end of the new MDX taken from a low aspect. And they look almost identical.
Yeah. Oh, and I mean, it's not necessarily a bad thing. They are nicely styled, if a lot more conservative than they went in the past with that giant shield grill and stuff. I mean, I feel like they're a little bit more together than past Acuras over the last few years, but they they're not standouts. I mean, when you look at an auto show, I mean, look around, you saw the Nissan Sport concept sedan, which was basically the next Maxima. We sort of mentioned this a little bit. I mean, that really, it pushes the styling envelope a lot more than the Acura, and they're both headed for production.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's going to be, you know, you can turn the volume down on the sports sedan concept about 20%. Or maybe even a little bit more. I've heard that it's actually really close to the production car, which would be pretty impressive, just for the boldness of it compared to the current Maxima that we've been living with for quite a while.
Which, I mean, the current Maxima, if you look at it, like, that's not an understated car. It's certainly got some exuberance to its styling. It's just we've seen it now for a few years too. But I remember when that first debuted, it was the thing. It was quite a thing.
I've got to be honest with you. I mean, I was hoping for really exciting things out of this car, and visually it is exciting, but it doesn't grab me in a good way. There's a lot going on. I mean, there's lines all over the place on this car. There's so much surface development on the hood and in the fenders. You know, it seems pretty wild and excessive. I didn't hear a whole lot of great feedback from my contemporaries out there. I think the floating roof line is sort of interesting. I haven't seen that done, that sort of cantilevered look. And I think that's done better than something like, say, the blacked out...
put on the XJ?
Yeah.
That's what, I mean, it reminds me of that. And you look at it and you go, it's kind of neat. That's interesting. And in terms of not being exciting, we know it's going to be pretty much Altima based, right? Altima current Maxima 3.5 liter V6, which is fine. That's a wonderful V6 paired with the CVT, which does quite well, but isn't exactly the most inspiring combo driving the front wheels either. So, look at this car and you're like, oh, I wish the rear wheels were driven and I wish I could shift it myself.
Yeah. But I mean, we are understandably a small percentage of. And we're not necessarily the people buying this car. And like I said earlier at the top of the show, the Maxima is a huge profit center for Nissan. And it does very, very well for them. And I don't think they hear people complaining that the wrong axles are doing the turning necessarily. So they're sticking to their knitting underneath. But the styling is definitely attention grabbing and definitely moves it away from the Altima pretty substantially.
Yeah, and that's a good thing, I think, and that's where the Maxima sort of fits is, like, again, that Buick Regal territory, right? Like, near luxury kind of, you know, somewhat, the Maxima is a little bit larger than the Altima, or maybe they're really close now. It started off larger than the Altima by a hair, but they sort of serve two different missions, and they're kind of like sleeper. It's a sleeper model out there. I'm surprised that it's such a profit center. I mean, it must be that everybody who buys the Maxima really wants it.
I mean, the transaction prices are quite handsome on that car. People buy them optioned up, and people that actually buy the cars, I think they just don't even look at the Altima. They don't look at it the same. The Maxima is a strong brand name, they've done real well with it. So I wouldn't expect them to change anytime soon.
Well, so overall, your impression of the Detroit show this year, I mean, you must be exhausted after covering it for 2 days.
I am. I'm not too exhausted to talk about one of the slam dunks of the show, though. The car that everybody was talking about, you know, among enthusiasts, was the Corvette Z06. And I think that's a tremendous accomplishment. I mean, if you look at this, I talked before wondering, you know, with the standard Stingray had so much going on visually, how they could differentiate it, you know, the extra badass versions. And they've done that with the Z06. It's got real presence. It's got incredible numbers. They say at least 625 horsepower and 635 foot-pounds of torque. And it's, you know, they had a cutaway model, and everything is very thoughtful. You know, the different castings that they've used, there's portions of the frame that are extruded, that are, you know, forged. It's all the way around. I mean, it's a tremendous vehicle. And they even talk about that there's a new 8-speed, which is what the automatic, which is what the Stingray needed at launch. I guess they just couldn't quite get the timing down. But with a torque converter, they're claiming that it's quicker than a PDK to shift, which is that's Porsche's dual clutch, and right. that is an amazingly quick transmission.
And I can believe that because it's not really like the torque converter isn't really the issue in an automatic. It's at that point, you know, it's I would assume it's locked up very quickly when you're accelerating like a drag race or, you know, 0 to 60 or quarter mile or something. It's just making the rest of the transmission shift quickly. And so that's, you know, that's impressive, though, that they can get the like a hydraulic automatic to shift that quick. And how do you feel about that too, though? The Z06 was always like, I read a thing on TTAC by Jack Baruth about it, and you know, in terms of like a guy whose opinion on high performance cars I respect, you know, he's a hell of a driver, and so I look at what he has to say, and it always tempers my opinion a little bit. He was not keen on the fact that now it's sort of like a softer, kinder, gentler Z06 in some ways, and maybe because it's no longer manual transmission only, and I will cut you if you look at me wrong kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I understand that, but if you want the real knuckle dragger experience, you're usually a Viper guy.
Yeah, I know. I like the Viper because it's like a bat to the head.
Yeah, no, and I like it for exactly that reason as well. You know, it's something where it's a challenge to master, and if you get it wrong, you're going to get it really wrong. I don't know. I mean, I don't think we know at this point how, you know, safe as houses the handling is going to be in this car. I think it's going to be really keen, though, because it's got incredible downforce. GM said it's got more downforce than any production vehicle they've ever tested. And that includes things like Ferraris and Lamborghinis and all that. It's got actual real race car like downforce. And the upshot of that is that it's probably only going to be as fast as the Stingray, if it's even that fast. Of course, it'll be quicker around a track, and it'll be quicker 0 to 60, but at the top end, because there's so much drag from the downforce, you know, it's not going to be any faster. But really, who cares? You don't need a 200-mile-an-hour streetcar.
Like us who write for blogs and our friends who read our writing and comment, I mean, we all want the numbers because that's all we have.
Well, you know, this is going to do the numbers everywhere else. It's going to do the acceleration numbers. And it's going to do the lap times like nobody's business. And if it comes in, you know, priced the way the outgoing ZR1 was or less, which is kind of what we're hearing, it's going to be even more of a bargain than the standard Stingray is, which is already an incredible buy.
Yeah. And it's just, again, with the Corvette, you know, you've got the performance variants that the standard Corvette pretty much walks all over everything within $20,000 or so. And then the performance variants basically create a supercar. You can push it up to what, say, 100K, and you've got something that is really untouchable for a lot of vehicles.
Yeah.
And in a lot of situations, too. I mean, it's a very well-engineered car. It's been that way since, you know, the C4 debuted, as hoary as that old thing is now. That was quite the thing when it debuted. And it really set the standard for the modern Corvette. And we're still seeing echoes of that with this sort of latest iteration. And maybe that's why you were a juror for this, for the North American Car and Truck of the Year. Maybe that's why you guys named the Stingray the 2014 North American Car of the Year, and the Truck / Utility of the Year was the Chevy Silverado. So it's a sweep for GM this year. Can you give us a little window into that, since you're part of the judging for that?
Sure. You know, the interesting thing about the award is that there really is no basis for you to decide. I mean, there's no guidelines for what you want to value. Do you want to value market impact? Do you want to value innovation? Do you want to value the performance of intended function, as Motor Trend likes to say? It's really up to the individual juror how you want to perceive these things. But I think, you know, in the case of the Corvette, it's an incredibly hard car to argue with. I mean, it brings a new level of performance to that price point. It has actual technological innovations Everything from, you know, the powertrain to little things like the way they let air escape from, you know, from the trunk of the car with this weird membrane thing that they electrify to open a vent. You know, the Russian dash cam thing with the you know, the on-screen telematics or on-track.
That's really cool, like with the video.
Yeah, no, it's amazing.
I mean, I think that's great. I mean, I was impressed with that. I mean, it was funny to see it show up at CES, but it's just cool. And
yeah.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, I mean, I think we were all pretty blown away by this vehicle, especially at the money. I mean, I had a manual transmission car with the Z51 performance package, which is a steel and a half, with stuff like dry sump lubrication and extra coolers and all of that for, you know, just a nominal increase. And I think mine was like 56K with some other small options. And it just, it'll wipe the pavement with, you know, most anything that's, you know, even double the price. So it was an easy shoe-in pick. I mean, it's kind of what I expected to happen. I actually really like the Mazda 3. And, you know, the nice thing about our awards is we're completely transparent about how we vote. You'll see the individual breakdown of how the jurors voted. I gave the Corvette a lot of points. I happen to give the Mazda 3 more points. But I'm perfectly pleased and proud to have that be the North American Car of the Year.
Yeah, and there was what were the I'm looking right now. I mean, the CTS was in the hunt too, and I was almost sure that the CTS was going to win. I came in sort of third in the voting, and then with the truck side, the Silverado won, and I was sure that the Cherokee was going to clinch it. It was sort of not really close. It was second to the Silverado. So, what's your sort of feeling for why the Silverado rated so highly? I mean, it's a good truck. It didn't sort of light my hair on fire with excitement, though. I mean, I liked it, but I thought, like, you know, there's a couple of things that I'm not all that thrilled about, and I like the Ram better.
Sure. And I think, you know, people, some of the jurors look at things, again, like market impact and totality of performance. And, you know, the Silverado is a really incredible vehicle. I mean, in that it's very well rounded. There's very few burrs on the thing. It delivers a newfound level of noise, vibration, harshness control. You know,
that's
It's super quiet.
It is.
And it's got a lot of little, not necessarily even things that are innovations, but small things that mean a big deal. Even things like the corner step bumper. I mean, I kind of laughed that off initially, but it's pretty handy. The thing is, I think they had that in the Avalanche before. They don't like to talk about that.
It did, but you know what's nice is, like, Ford has like the staircase that folds out of the tailgate, and the GM solution was just like, well, we'll just cut a notch in the side of the bumper and put a little insert, and it's like elegant and handy.
Sure.
And I like that elegance with it. And when I had the Silverado and the Sierra as well, like, I use that feature all the time.
Yeah. And you know, I don't want to, you know, delve too deep into the reasoning of other jurors, because I don't actually know what goes into their head sometimes. But I think, you know, what happened here is the Silverado came out pretty early. So we've all had the chance to get a lot of time with it. And get comfortable with it and see what impact it's having on the market, and to get, you know, feedback from our peers and all of that. And it's gotten really good feedback. The Cherokee came out late. The Cherokee was delayed with quality control problems, you know, which, to their credit, they worked to get right before they launched the vehicle. And I think that was totally the right strategy. But it sort of kept that vehicle out of mindshare, I think, up until we were pretty far along in our voting process. That is actually the vehicle that I voted for with the most points. I think it brings something new to the segment. I think it is innovative. I still don't care for the way it looks, and it should tell you something that I overlook, you know, something that I think is still pretty fundamental, even if it's just an aesthetic judgment, to give it the most points, because I think, you know, its off-road ability doesn't come at, you know, at any cost, really. And you know, it still rides well. It still has great technology inside, And I think it's a really unique offering in the segment.
I mean, look where they're coming from, too. They're coming from the Liberty. This is filling the Liberty hole, which, you know, the Liberty was popular. And a lot of people liked that vehicle, and it sold okay. I expect that they're going to do a lot better with the Cherokee because they've really upped their game, and it's almost like give the people what they want, and that certainly seems to hit all the right notes. And that's why I think I was a little bit surprised that it didn't do better. But you're right. You know, I didn't think about that. We've seen the Silverado, like, that debuted before Detroit last year.
Mm-hmm. So it's had a lot of mindshare time, you know, and I'm not surprised at the results. I thought the Cherokee could eke out a win. But if I were a betting man, this is the way I would have expected them to finish.
Well, I'm sure GM is pretty happy about it now, so we'll see who sweeps it next year.
Yeah, and they deserve it. This is only the third sweep in history. I think Ford managed it, and Honda managed it before. So,
yeah, and it just, I mean, so now GM has gotten a bunch of new stuff out. Next year, you know, we'll see somebody else come out with some new stuff too, because, you know, it all goes in cycles, and so I sort of follow with interest how the Car and Truck of the Year judging goes. I mean, there's a lot of awards, but it's still sort of one of the, I mean, automakers make hay with it, so. It gets mentioned, and it's just interesting to see where everybody else's opinion comes in and the arguments for or against a particular vehicle. Because honestly, the field is very strong. I mean, you had.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, it definitely is. And, you know, GM with all of its product offerings, and most of them were really fantastic. They kind of stuffed the ballot box this year early on. I mean, they had, I think, 7 or 8 vehicles in there, things like the Impala and the CTS, and they really had a good shot at it. I'm really proud to be on this jury. I think it is a different award. You know, it's completely nonprofit. We all pay into it, if you believe that. People say that journalists don't pay for anything. We actually pay to make this award happen. You know, we don't take outside funding. We're not tied to a magazine. We're not tied to an auto show. So I think, you know, it's a different type of award. So even if it doesn't make, you know, the same amount of hay as a Motor Trend Car of the Year, I think it's something that internally, you know, within the community of automakers and of journalists, we're all pretty proud of.
But, I mean, how is the buffet lunch? I mean, that's...
No buffet lunch, man. We can't afford it.
All the money goes into the judging. All right. Well, I think that we've, you know, pretty significantly covered the Detroit show, although I'm sure there's a few things that we've missed because, you know, it's an auto show and there's always stuff that falls between the cracks. Let's hit a couple of questions and then we'll call it a night. So since the F-150 debuted, Thomas writes in, you know, how could GM miss that Ford was going aluminum? I don't think they missed it at all. I think GM just spent billions of dollars making their trucks, and they're going to sit back and try to make some money off of it and see what happens with the aluminum thing. Do you think maybe that the next generation of GM trucks might be a lot more lightweight intensive?
I think they're going to look at the F-150 really hard. I don't think they missed it either. I think you're exactly right on that. Let's also remember that the Silverado and Sierra, they were delayed vehicles because of the bankruptcy. Those trucks were actually supposed to be out long before they actually came to market. And Ford did. They've been, you know, constantly developing their vehicle in the meantime. And of course, you know, General Motors had less resources to devote to their trucks for a while, too. And there's probably something to be said for letting that, you know, another competitor bite the bullet on the cost of aluminum and see how things shake out.
Yeah, well, and they've worked with Alcoa. So, you know, that if GM wants to do it, they'll go knock on the door and say, hey, Alcoa, we'd love to partner with you. Some of that stuff you did with Ford that's not proprietary, some of those things that you learned, we'll pay you a lot of money to be our manufacturing partner for our next truck. I think you're going to see a lot more aluminum. I think it's going to be a lot more widespread because we've got, you know, everybody's staring down the barrel of these new CAFE requirements that are getting tighter and tighter and tighter, and we want cars that still perform and, you know, still have all the safety stuff on them. So, you know, how do you make that efficiency number? You cut weight. And how do we do that? With, you know, more different and more exotic materials. I mean, aluminum's a pretty well-known quantity. It's far from exotic, but we're getting to the point now where, you know, we have to find those ways to not just go with exotic powertrains either. You know, like you can't make a hybrid out of everything. So it's going to be the industry-wide in the next few years is my prediction. We're going to see a lot more use of aluminum. So we didn't talk too much about the Subaru WRX. Bob from New Hampshire wanted to know, he says Subaru's on the right track with developing the enthusiast market with the Crosstrek Impreza and keeping the manual models. With the advent of the automatic WRX and Forester XT, are we seeing the last hurrah for the manual transmission?
You know, I think Americans have been pretty good about holding on to the manual. You know, it's funny. We always looked abroad at Europe and said, well, look, those guys still drive manuals. And yes, they do as a percentage drive more manuals. But the thing that we're seeing is when automakers do introduce a manual transmission, it tends to be these days on performance cars because of America. We saw BMW introduce manual models of things like the M5 and really only market them here. We see a new, you know, 7-speed manual transmission on the Corvette. And so I think we're holding on to it. But yeah, I mean, as the cost of developing everything gets more and more expensive, and dual clutches get better and better, and fewer people are being raised learning how to drive manual transmissions, I do think down the road it's kind of an inevitability that you're not going to see new manual transmissions.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. I mean, I think that in the other parts of the world, auto racing like F1 is a lot more popular. And those kind of cars use the automated manuals and things like, you know, PDK. And so I feel like that's something that those markets, you know, they want those kind of things where you're seeing the rise of the automatic. And when we, us and you know, U.S.-based enthusiasts think about it, we still think of moving the stick. And it's two different cultures sort of clashing, which is it's interesting to see that difference in. I'm really pleased that some automakers are still, you know, pandering to us.
you know, one thing that was brought to my attention today by Michael Harley, one of our contributors, I don't know how widespread this thought process is, and I don't remember exactly where it came from. But he said, you know, automakers are increasingly happy to put together things like dual clutch transmissions and high performance automatics over manual because they can control the abuse on the cars quite a bit more. You can control things for over rev, you know, exactly. You can control the conditions of the abuse a lot more. So that results in lower warranty costs, higher residuals in theory, lower failure rates. So there's that added little wrinkle that it never really even occurred to me.
That's very business.
Yeah.
I bet it's not far from the truth either, but that's just not exciting. All right. So you're in Detroit or, you know, Detroit area. So this last question, I think, is good for you. Dane asked, you know, having attended the Detroit show in the past, the transition from glittering candy clear coat and beautiful models to the actual streets of Detroit is overwhelming. What stories do you have of, like, working in the environment? You know, how does it change your perspective of Detroit to see like the auto show and then sort of Detroit proper? Are you, and I know this is sort of not exactly a car question. It's more of like a Motor City sort of feeling question, especially given what the city's going through. You know, it's a manufacturing base and we've got some of our best loved companies here doing a good job building products, but their hometown is sort of under duress. What's your feeling about, you know, how's that going to go for the next few years?
Well, I think, you know, the attitude has been, you know, around here, head down, business as usual. I've had a lot of people from outside of the area when the state of bankruptcy was finally declared say, what does that mean for everybody? How's everybody dealing with it? You know, like they expect like suddenly the streetlights don't work any more or less than they already did. So the reality is everybody's just keeping on. And, you know, I don't know. I mean, you know, the roads outside got hot patched right in front of the Kobo, and I'm sure that was not a coincidence that was done there. And there's a, you know, rehabs hotel that just popped up, and there's definitely pockets of great things happening. But, you know, overall, I think there's people that are here are very prideful, and I mean that in a positive way. And they're willing to kind of, you know, do the work. If you live in the city, as I did for a few years, you know, the people that are making the you know, the city work are small businesses, they're startups. And, you know, there's still a lot of established major suppliers here in addition to the automakers. And, you know, I've even been hearing that the Chinese are looking to establish things here. Because we have such a robust supplier base, and because we have such strong engineering resources,
yeah.
You know, is the city going to come back to be the way that it was? I mean, I think we've talked about this before. No, it never will.
How does a resurgent sort of domestic auto industry? I mean, you've seen Chrysler. Basically, Chrysler is now flipped and turned into the life support system for Fiat.
Sure.
And you've got Ford that's, you know, doing a lot better than, I mean, everybody, Ford and GM, they're both, and Chrysler, they're all doing a lot better in the last 2 years than they did in the last, you know, seven before that. So things are looking up for the biggest industries there. Does that play a role in, you know, in Detroit sort of managing to hang on and to turn things around in the few years into the future?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, again, it's a point of pride. It's a point of income, and a point of relevancy for the whole state, not just for Detroit, and really for the whole region and for the country. So I think it's a, you know, it's a buoy. I don't want to mix metaphors here. It's a buoy and an anchor at the same time. It's kind of weird that I just said that, but there you are.
It's neutrally buoyant.
It is all those things, Dan. I think it really helps. And I think, you know, we're working through our other problems here, and having a strong industry, you know, come back, making big dollars, gaining, you know, the respect of the world, one vehicle at a time, when we know it's not just, you know, handed out anymore. That's, you know, it means a lot.
Yeah, I mean, the nuts and bolts of the city right now is, like, its population is, it sort of peaked at 2 million, and that's when things were flushed, and it was great. And now it sort of immediately, once it peaked at 2 million, it started to reverse as well. And so now you're down to, you know, a city that's sized with public services to support 2 million people, and there's 700,000 people living there. So it's, you know, tax revenue and stuff is tough, but it's cyclical, right? And we've seen this, you know, even here in New England. I was just in LA. LA is the same kind of thing too. I was in downtown LA, which was like, yeah, 10, 15 years ago, people didn't come to downtown LA and stay there on business, and they weren't like walking around going to cool restaurants, you know, at 9 o'clock at night. And so it runs in cycles. And so I think Detroit is going to be doing better in the next 5 years than they have in the last 20. You know, they got to get some good management in there and work through some things. But yeah, I mean, I think the auto show does put it in stark relief, where you've got everybody from all over the world bringing their high powered wares to the Kobo, and then you've got the reality outside the doors. But it's really no different than, like, in New York in that sense. Like, you know, you go out the doors of the Javits and you're in Manhattan, you're not in, like, car nirvana. So it's
no, and it's not that. I mean, I think there's still some infrastructure needs. I mean, they've done a good job of updating Kobo. You know, last year when we did the, you know, the car of the year award ceremony, it was cold, and, you know, there were, like, you know, plastic tarps blowing around and all of that because they were in process. They've completed a lot of the renovations there. But it's, you know, it's still a town that probably doesn't have enough new hotel rooms in the immediate area. And certainly the road surface needs work, and parking was really difficult this year. And so there's infrastructure needs. It's not a perfect show. And it's certainly a difficult time of year to expect people from around the world to want to fly into Detroit. But it still has a lot to offer.
So there we go. I think that's the very long-winded answer to something that was supposed to be a short answer. But yeah, I mean, the Detroit show always leaves everybody sort of, you know, we got to pause, take a breath. And then we're looking at what, Geneva and New York. And there's a couple of others that I'm forgetting off the top of my head. But we're in the thick of auto show season now.
Don't forget Chicago, man.
Chicago, yes, the largest by square footage auto show in the United States, something like that. Hey, we've got Boston starting on Thursday, so I mean, you know, I actually had somebody ask me, like, don't auto shows have these really awesome concept cars? Because I went to the Boston Auto Show last year and I didn't see any of that. I was like, yeah, you got to understand, the Boston Auto Show runs at the very same time as Detroit, so.
Priorities.
Yeah. It's
yeah, just... and frankly, there are less concepts than there used to be, right? And yeah. The ones that there are a little more near term and not sort of open wallet future think.
Yeah. I mean, I will say, you know, if you want parking to be easy, go to Chicago. And I think with that, we've done another Autoblog podcast for this week, the Detroit edition. So I want to thank you, Chris Pockert, executive editor of Autoblog, for joining me.
Thank you. Great to be here, as always.
And we will catch you guys next week. Thanks. The Autoblog podcast is brought to you by TireRack.com, the leading online source for tires and so much more, including a large selection of winter tires, as well as aftermarket wheels, suspension, and brake components, and those items that make it easier to see, like windshield wipers and replacement lighting. No matter what your vehicle, check them out at TireRack.com. You can subscribe to the Autoblog podcast in iTunes, send us an email at podcast@autoblog.com, or find us on Twitter @AutoblogPodcast. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.